And then she makes me look her in the eye, which I do because it's color and she needs me to see inside her so I'll know she's telling me the truth. I never let Coop touch me. Not like he thinks. Never. I swear. Charlie, I swear. I tell her, okay. And then I look away because what is behind her eyes is bright and loud, but also dark and fading. And the contradiction confuses me. I can't let myself get confused now, not about anything. I picture Levi opening a door for her, putting his arm around her and giving her a soft kiss on the top of her head, stroking her cheek, running his hands through her hair. They have been inseparable since the day they met. Now I picture him Friday night, thinking the wrong things about his girl, his woman. Keller waits for more words from me, but I don't have them. The truth is, Agent Zellman is in my head. My mom is in my head. And my childish delusions about Keller and Levi and their true love defying gravity, all of it is up for reevaluation. My very foundation is crumbling. She looks at me as she lights another cigarette. Charlie? Yeah? About Friday night. Don't. I stop her. We swore not to ever talk about Friday night, and we have to stick to it. I haven't said a word about anything to anyone, and I don't want anything else in my head that could come out if they make me. I've done what I've done to protect her. I've come here tonight to protect her, but also Janice and Nora and Levi, all of them. She says then, can you just tell me if he's safe? If Levi will be okay? I take the cigarette even though it's started to make me sick. I'm grasping at anything to stop feeling what I feel, to shut down my brain. I open my mouth to give her an answer, but something catches my eye, out on the street. I toss the cigarette and pull her back against the house, tighter, so we're less visible. What's wrong? She asks. A car is creeping slowly, then stops far enough away from the front of her house that I can't tell what kind it is. There is one person inside, a faceless shadow. And it doesn't get out. Go inside, I tell her. And we do. We climb inside the window and I close it and lock it behind me. Then I tell her to go downstairs and lock every door. I do the same up here with the windows. When we're done, I make her take a shower and wash her face and change her clothes. I give her one of Dot's sleeping pills and it clouds over the worry, the despair, the sorrow, and the fear. And she goes to sleep. And me? I get a knife from the kitchen, and I sit in a chair in the living room where I can see out a crack in the draperies. I sit and watch until the car backs up all the way down the street, and the headlights disappear. Chapter 17. That night, I sleep in fits and starts. I sleep long enough to dream about things that I don't want to see, not ever again. I see everyone I love in pain. I see Nora smoking outside, her face swollen with worry, powerless to stop what's happened on her watch and in her good name. I see Janice exploding in tears and rage and Coop stifling laughter right in front of her as she stands before him protecting her child's honor, his dignity. I see Keller with bruises and Levi opening doors and Coop touching her and Dot in the bathroom, skin hanging from bones. I see my mom back in our shitty apartment, crawling on hands and knees as she duct tapes the floorboards. I see the things Ian and I did last summer when we were alone with the stirring that had finally caught up to us. How it makes me think about Ian day and night, night and day, his hands on my body, my hands on his body, under our clothes, inside our clothes, deep, wet kisses. And a longing that still feels like a runaway train pulling me off the tracks that I have so carefully laid down to get me out of here. I see Coop's face always dirty, that spot on his head shining with sweat. I see metal pans with shredded lettuce, plastic wrap, a tomato slicer. Rage and money and blood and bleach. One giant thud in my chest hurls me into consciousness as thoughts of Agent Zellman and Dot and a car backing down the street chase away the remnants of the dream. Adrenaline surges, then recedes, leaving me more exhausted than when I felt my eyes start to close. The knife is on the floor beside the chair, fallen from my hand. I check my phone. It's just after 6 a.m. I look outside through the crack in the draperies and see nothing but a boy walking a dog and a woman bringing a garbage bin to the street. The sky is still dim. I shuffle to the stairs, groggy, head spinning, stomach sick from the cigarettes and no food and churning fear. The house is quiet and cold and dark. The heat is off to save money, but I find the thermostat and turn it on so they can wake up with some comfort. I start the coffee pot in the kitchen the way I do for my mom on Saturday mornings when she likes to sleep late. I want to stay and be here when Keller wakes up and has to handle Dot, get her up and dressed and fed and then settled in front of the TV so she can watch her shows. It's Monday, so they will all be on. That will make her happy and give Keller some peace. Maybe she'll come to work today. She needs to get out of this house. But I have to go. I leave cash in the coffee can on the top shelf of a cabinet, where I always do every week. One third of my paycheck, which I have allowed for on my spreadsheet and which Keller has been saving to pay for a room in a private facility for Dot. When she has enough for one full year, she'll use the time to work more and save more for the next year. And she'll keep doing this for as many years as are left for Dot. She just needs that one leg up, that first year to get out from under. It's such a small thing, but the can is not nearly full enough. I leave through the back door, locking it, then replacing the spare key to the lantern. I find my mom's car on the street and drive. Ian lives 2 miles away on Rosebury Lane. I've never been there. He moved after we broke up over a year ago, after he graduated from high school and got the job as a cop. I've never been there because of the things my mom told me and that I know to be true, even if I hate both of us for it. I drive to Rosebury Lane, and I look for his police car. It's easy to find. I park on the street a few houses down from the car. I don't see any lights on, so I wait. I know it won't be long before he's up and getting ready for work. I settle in, wrapping my jacket tightly around me. I pull my knees to my chest, lean my head back, and my mind goes to him in that house as I study every inch of it. The windows, and the shades, and the curtains, and the front porch, and the flowers that line the walkway that I'm sure his mother planted. I wonder where he sleeps, where he eats, where he cooks and makes his coffee. I wonder if he sits on that porch and drinks a beer and thinks about anything beyond the day before him, or looks for the orange Buick that ran over his dead father. I wonder if he cares about his future, about me, or someone else. I wonder what it would be like to be in that house with him. Away from my mom and Dusty and their boys, free like Nora to do what I want, in love like Keller, lying in bed under the covers, bodies wrapped together, hands, mouths, skin, everything moving together to become one. Ian is the only boy I have ever loved, the only boy who has ever made me feel the stirring. The only boy who has ever made me want to run as fast as I can away from childhood and into his arms, into my body, and out of my head. I remember the first time I felt it, when I knew what my mom had warned me about, when my eyes lit up and my heart nearly exploded with joy. Ian knew me. He knew the things that caused my body to shake and my fingers to tap and my head to get hot. It happened one day outside the school. I'd missed a question on a 9th grade science test of all the stupid things. It was about the respiratory system, which I knew better than anything. Better than algebra and sandwiches and the smell of my mom beside me when I was younger. It was just a brain hiccup. I'd been moving too fast. My eyes danced over the last part of a multiple choice answer, one of those dog shit tricks teachers like to play on us because they think they're clever. And I answered wrong. I knew it the second we left class. My mind was still on the test, seeing each question and each answer and checking my work as I walked to my locker with Keller and listened to her talk about some party we should go to. And I just saw it suddenly. The tricky end to the question appeared before my eyes. I ran from the building. Keller chased after me. Ian was outside already in line for his bus, and he left the line to come to us. I couldn't breathe. I was hyperventilating, tapping my fingers furiously. My head was on fire. Keller was frantic, calling out my name because I wasn't responding. But Ian was calm. "Charlie," he said, "follow my breath." And then he inhaled and exhaled and inhaled and exhaled. Slowly and with a loud sound, and it was impossible not to do the same, like the way someone's yawn makes you yawn too, I felt a wave of something hypnotic, a drug, a potion. My heart steadied and I caught a huge gulp of air that reached deep in my lungs. "You're all right now," he told me. And I was. I was all right. I looked at his face. My eyes met his eyes. And that was it. The moment I felt the stirring for the very first time. The night I decided we had to stop never leaves me. It sits in the back of my brain like a faucet, and from that faucet is a constant drip of remorse. Lying together in the back of his truck, under the hand of God, feeling his body close to mine, feeling his hands on my back touching my skin. "Does it feel good?" he asked me, but he knew it did. Because my shoulders were dancing against his chest, and that was one of the many things he knew about me and loved about me. We might as well have been cast in a cautionary video they showed at school about abstinence and consent and safe sex. "It's hard to stop," the commentator warned. When you get to that point where hormones have taken over, where biology has been let out of its cage, let off its leash, let loose to trample your will, your better judgment, your self-control. Ian said we could stop, and there were always ways to be safe. And yet, there was always a chance of a mistake. That's what I said to myself. It was about the risks and the fear of being on the bad side of the statistics. A failure for the system that tries to get us past the stage without a mishap. That tried to trick God's trick. But that wasn't it. No one talks about what happens to girls in towns like this. No one but my mom. It makes me hate her. It makes me love her. Because she's right, but I don't want her to be. The stirring goes away the second it's ruined your life. Her words have stuck in my mind, and I don't even remember when she said them because she talked so much and all the time. The question lingered that night. "Can I kiss you?" The answer was yes, and I wanted him to, but I wanted other things more, and I was the only one who could save me. I didn't cry that night. What I felt was too big for tears, too big for tapping fingers or rocking back and forth. It was so big, I turned into a zombie. Ian drove me home, angry, frustrated, but also sad because I told him it had to be over. I could never be this strong again. He let me out in front of Dusty's house and he drove off. And that was that. A lifetime of friendship. And now love finally expressed. And I had blown it to shreds. His mother begged him to leave. When he didn't, she begged him to live at home while he saved money. She begged him to take the scholarship at the school he got into up north in Maine. I remember when he was accepted to that college. I remember his face when he showed me the letter. I will never see that face again. Because what his father put inside him is something worse than what my mom put inside me. Cullen McGuire was a good man. That's how the story goes. He was a good man who had been a good kid until he saw something that he couldn't stop seeing. The boy from his class dying on that mountain, falling from the narrow trail and tumbling down, bouncing off of rocks that lined the ledge, which bashed in his head and scraped off his skin until he landed on the ground below. People like a gruesome tale, and this one had been embellished over time. How could it not? Only 3 people saw it happen, and one of them was tortured, one of them was gone, and the other was Clay Cooper, who never let a chance to shock and awe pass him by. Coop liked to tell people about the thud the body made when it hit the ground far, far below. But Cullen McGuire never spoke of it again. Not after he told the police what happened. How the boy, whose name was Rudy Benton, was there 1 second and then falling the next. But none of that matters. What matters is that Cullen McGuire never got over it, and he made himself feel better by drinking, and this made it hard for him to hold down a job. It's why his wife only had 1 child, Ian, and why she worked 2 jobs the whole time he was growing up. His father was even drunk on the night he died. The police came to believe he got out of his car on his way home from a bar to take a piss, and some passerby hit him in the dark, then drove away, thinking maybe he was a deer. The police knew the make and model of the car from the tire marks and the paint scrapes left on Cullen McGuire's car, and even some on his body. They found an old woman in Sawyer who owned a car like that, but she had reported the car stolen 2 weeks before. The officers say they looked as hard as they could for as long as they could, but the car never turned up, and the case went cold. Ian was only 10 when all of this happened. But when he got older, when he was old enough to think about it and draw his own conclusions, he came to believe something different. He thought that the stolen car and the back road, which wasn't on the way home from the bar his father liked to frequent, and the fact that there was paint on his car didn't add up to the story the police had fed his mother. Who would think they hit a deer if their car scraped another car enough to leave paint marks? As Ian said when he first told me about it, why would a deer be standing next to a parked car on the side of a road? Ian believed someone hit his father and drove off, a hit and run. And he didn't care that it was probably an accident, maybe even his father's fault for being so drunk he was pissing in the middle of a road. He wanted that someone to pay. So he started looking for that 1996 orange Buick LeSabre, and he was still looking to this day. The VIN number for the car was never registered again. He told me once, and I wrote it down in case he forgot to. XPG749TYW8643PL97. Everyone tried to tell him it was probably sold for parts or junked after the accident, but it was his only lead. Ian McGuire, the boy I love, the only boy I have ever loved, would never leave Sawyer or go to college or stop looking for that car or stop being a cop where at least he could make other people pay for other crimes. He would never get over his father's death, who never got over his friend's death. And that's one of the saddest things I've ever seen, even next to Keller and her sick grandmother. I knock just once, then wait. Ian answers. He's taken aback when he sees me. I can't imagine what I look like after the night I've had. "Hey," he says. We stand there, awkwardly, even though I just saw him the day before and cried on his flannel shirt. "Do you want to come in?" he asks. He opens the door, and I see inside, and God help me, I want to walk in. But I can't. I just can't do it, or I may never, ever leave. "I'm good," I say, like an idiot. And he pulls the door closed behind him and stands with me on his porch. He's dressed in his uniform, and it hugs his body, and my body responds, defying the orders I have just laid out. I get to the point. I tell him about Agent Zellman, and I show him the business card. I wrote down his badge ID number on the back as soon as he got out of the car, because I knew this could be one of the times my memory failed me. I'd been terrified, and terror is not good for remembering, or for anything, really, except maybe saving your life. I tell him about the car in the back of the Triple S, how Agent Zellman followed me all day and knew things about me and snuck into my mom's car. I have no reason to doubt Agent Zellman, but there is a rule about trusting strangers. Rule number 31, trust but verify, because everybody lies sometimes. "I don't get it, Charlie. Why does he think you know something?" Ian looks worried, and I remember that he has no idea about the camera at the store, about the video the police saw. I stall for time because I've never lied to Ian, but now I think I have to somehow. I have to protect him. I have to protect everyone. My head is getting hot as I make my list of them. And then I think that I have to get out of here. I shouldn't have come. Because what if Barry is watching me and now he knows that Ian is one of my people in that car that was at Keller's? He knows about her too. I'm making things worse and worse and worse. "Charlie." Ian reaches out because my fingers are tapping. And he thinks he can just work his magic and calm me down, but he can't. Not this time. "I have to go," I say. And I think I really do. I have to leave this place. The worst place in the world. It's the place where dreams die and girls go down dead-end streets and men like Coop and Dusty take everything that's good and keep it for themselves. And now Barry is here, watching me. And wanting to hurt the people I love. Ian backs off. He looks at me with more concern than I've ever seen before. Ever. "I'll check out this agent for you as soon as I get to the office, okay?" I nod. Breathe. Force my fingers into a fist so they remain still. And then I run, like a scared little mouse. I run down the steps of his porch on Rosebery Lane and cross the street and into my mom's car. And then I drive away. Chapter 18. When I get back to Dusty's house, I find him and my mom waiting for me in the kitchen. It's Monday morning and I've been out all night. Plus, I should be at school. Plus, the boys had to take the bus because I had my mom's car. Plus, Dusty should be at work, but now he has to go in late because of me and the worry I've caused. "Where have you been?" Dusty speaks first in his most serious voice. I try to get away without sitting down at the island as I ramble about Keller needing me to help with Dot and falling asleep at her house. "Can you please sit down?" he asks, now in his nicer voice. There's not much difference between the two. Dusty is a successful lawyer, even if, as Regina Cooper said in the bathroom, they were all just ambulance chasers. Dusty doesn't chase ambulances exactly, but he does have his picture on a billboard out on the interstate. I think if you have a billboard, you may not be chasing ambulances, but you are still telling them where to drop off the sick patients. Dusty says that in towns like this one, that have been wrecked by problems with the economy and then never bounced back, there's no more money that ever comes in. What's here is here. And that money, he says, flows like water, finding its way through any crack and crevice a person can chisel. People with more try to build dams. People with less chip away at those dams with whatever tools they can find. Charity programs, welfare programs, and suing. Dusty says it's ironic that some of their tools actually just move money from those with more to others with more, like him. Because he gets 1/3 of everything they're awarded when they slip and fall. He always makes air quotes with his fingers when he says those words. Slip and fall. The point is, Dusty is clever. Maybe not as clever as Clay Cooper was, but clever enough not to risk his good reputation by protecting me. He's worried now. I can see it on his face, but not like my mom is worried. I sit down on the stool at the end of the island, and the two of them turn so they can see me. Now, my mom speaks. "We think you should quit that job, Charlie. Those people at the SSS, I didn't realize the sort of people they were, and now they've gotten you into this mess." I tried to make sense of her words. I know what she's saying, of course. I just don't see how Coop's murder makes them all a sort of anything. Nora is different from Janice, and they are both different from Keller, and Levi doesn't even work there. Tracy and Helen are, as far as I can tell, irrelevant to the conversation. Then I think about Agent Zellman and the things Coop was involved in. I think that maybe I should just blurt it all out and let them sit there with their mouths gaping open in disbelief. But I don't know what would happen next. If they would tell the detectives or my new lawyer with the navy pantsuit, or if Dusty would use his power to track down Agent Zellman's boss and demand some answers. If I was in danger, then being in his house meant that his boys were in danger. And Dusty may not love me, but he does love his boys, who are named after him and his father. I don't want to act out of desire for momentary pleasure at the expense of my long-term best interests. Rule number 10. Impulsive behavior happens when the emotional brain hijacks the thinking brain. I'm tired and freaking out. The perfect cocktail for an emotional hijacking. My brain is in fight or flight mode, and that's never a good time to make any decision, unless you really do need to fight or take flight. I have to stop the words that want to explode out of my mouth. "Charlie," Dusty says when I don't answer. "Did you hear your mother?" I can feel Dusty's disdain from across the marble countertop, and my fingers start tapping. Together, together, right, then left, then right. Together, together, right, then left, then right. I can smell his old man smell. The big shot lawyer, the town council member. The man who wouldn't be anything 200 miles from here, north or south. The slightly above ambulance chaser helping people chisel holes in the dam so he can take a third. And then I get a burst of something cool and clear. I come up with an alternative that will make their mouths gape, but also serve my interests. And I'm so proud. I want to give myself a medal. I look up and find his eyes, and my fingers stop tapping. And I say, "I can't quit my job. I need the money more than ever now that the council voted to give the scholarship to a football player." My mom shrieks, "What are you talking about?" Dusty is flustered. His face gets red, and I think about his head getting hot just like mine, because we all get that sometimes. We're all human. And when you get busted for doing a shitty thing, it's hard to control your emotions. So there. How do you know about that? Dusty asks. I shrug. This makes him even more angry. My mom doesn't care how I know. I knew she wouldn't. All she cares about is what she's sacrificed so I could get out of here, and how this man she tolerates has just slipped the rug out from under both of us. Is it true? Did you vote to give the money to some jock over Charlie? Dusty sighs and looks at his hands, which are sweating like Coop's bald spot. He got into Alabama. Almost a full ride. Now my mom. So what? Charlie got into MIT. Do you even know what that is? What that means? Now Dusty gets defensive. And then what? What happens after that, Eileen? This kid will have to support a family one day. He'll have a wife and a mortgage and kids. And Charlie will do what? Study math for the rest of her life? Who's going to hire her to do anything except make sandwiches? I see flames come from my mom's ears, like in the cartoons I watched when I was a kid. They were both mad at me. And now my mom is mad at Dusty, and Dusty has to defend himself. And suddenly me working at the Triple S and making our family look bad by being involved with that sort of people is the last thing on either of their minds. It's like a dog in a yard full of squirrels. They can chase one squirrel all day, but the second they spot a new squirrel, they start chasing that one. Rule number 6. People are easily distracted. I leave them with this new squirrel and head for the stairs. I tell them I need to get ready for school, and I don't know if they hear me, but I do know that it's not long before I hear doors slam and cars start, and then my world is quiet and still. In my bedroom, I close the door and turn a full circle. Everything is exactly where I left it not 24 hours before, except for me. I am turned upside down and inside out, and I don't know where to begin. I sit on the floor, which is covered in a shaggy beige carpet. I take off my sneakers and my socks and let my feet sink into the polyester, which I have hated since the day we moved here, but which now tickles my feet and gives me enough physical distraction to slow my heart and steady my breath. I pull my knees to my chest and rest my forehead on them. I don't close my eyes because then I will see either darkness or images from the last 2 days, and that will not help. Instead, I stare at the button on my jeans. I thought I would go to school and then to work and wait for Ian to tell me about Adrian Zellman. I thought I would just carry on, because I was full of adrenaline, which numbs pain, and that has been useful, but now it's gone. Now I feel all kinds of pain, the kind that comes from worrying. I can't deny what Agent Zellman told me. I can't deny what it means. I have to face it. I have to see it now. When my legs start to cramp, I know I have to get up off the floor. I have to think about this new information the way I think about the inventory at the Triple S or a problem on a test. And I can't make a mistake like the one on that test when I lost my shit and Ian calmed me with his magic. No mistakes. There is a solution to everything, an outcome that can be created or evaded or manipulated. If Barry is watching me to see what I know or what I might have, then I need to watch him right back. A plan forms as I stand and let the blood flow through my shaky legs. When they stop shaking, I begin to execute it by making a list and doing the things on the list, one at a time, in order so I don't miss a step. No mistakes, no mistakes. First, the box of lotion in my mom's vanity drawer. the box that has no lotion inside but wads of money and large bills she's been taking from Dusty here and there, from his wallet, from his car, from the ladies when they go out for lunch and my mom pays the entire bill on his card, then takes their cash. Still there. Check. Second, my closet, and the shelf at the top, and the teddy bear that sits there, along with other remnants from my childhood that I no longer cling to. I open the Velcro on the back that hides a very large battery pack, because the bear talks and moves his arms when there are batteries installed. But the battery pack has been removed, leaving just the hole. I slip my fingers inside and pull out the small flip phone I took from the floor of the prep room, where it fell from Clay Cooper's pocket the night he died. I turned it off before bringing it into this house because I didn't know what kind of phone it was, and I didn't want it to send a signal and be tracked here. What I do know is that his other phone, his fancy new smartphone, was found on his body. So when Agent Zellman said his phone was missing from the crime scene, he must have known that Coop had two phones, which means he knows even more than he was telling me. Maybe from the police. Maybe from other people he's also trying to turn to for information against Barry. Or maybe from his surveillance. I wonder how long he's been watching Coop and Barry and whoever else. I wonder if he has photos of them talking and handing off money and Coop using different phones, including the one I hold in my hands, which is now part of a federal investigation. This phone that I hold in my hands is evidence. The kind of evidence that could cause a lot of trouble for someone. And I don't know what to do with it. My plan isn't finished because I don't have the tools to finish it. I have math and remembering and everything I know about people, but now I have done things I can't undo. Bad things, like taking this phone. Things that have put me in this bad situation. It doesn't matter why I did them. It doesn't matter that I was trying to protect the people I care about, even if I don't know which one I'm protecting. Who wanted Coop dead? All of them. All of them. I can't remember one second in my life when I haven't been afraid of disappointing someone. Even if they said nothing, I would feel it ooze from their silence, their hushed words, their condescending comments. I would know in my gut and my bones and under my skin, their disappointment in me would come through loud and clear. Faces of friends I'd lost pass before my eyes. Countless faces who won't even remember me. That freak from first grade, that weirdo from gym class. I was nothing to them, and each time I had to let them go, I worked harder to be more like them. Enough like them that they would stop noticing how I wasn't. And now, what has it gotten me? A small circle of people I can trust. Ian, Keller, Janice, Nora, sometimes my mom. It's so little. It's too little. But it's all I have. And I can't lose it. I can't lose them. Chapter 19. Dusty has a gun. His father gave it to him when he became a man. It was some kind of family tradition. Every Madison gave it to his firstborn son, and that son gave it to his firstborn son, and so on. If no son had a son, then it was given to the next born male heir, because apparently women have no use for guns. The gun is very old, and my mom makes him keep it in the attic. He takes it out a few times a year to clean it and fire at empty cans in the woods with his boys. Seems like it's all a big waste of time, but the boys like it more than anything, maybe even more than video games. Rule number 4. All feelings are the result of chemical reactions in the brain. When Dusty takes his boys to shoot cans, he pats their back and hugs them and kisses them and tells them how much he loves them and this releases dopamine in their brains, which is a chemical that makes us feel good. So now just talking about that stupid gun and shooting cans in the woods makes them happy. I know the gun is kept in a box with Dusty's old trophies from sports when he was little. Dusty wasn't very athletic, so when I go up there to look for it, I start with the smaller boxes in the back. My mom has labeled the boxes so it's easier to find decorations for all of our holidays. And there are a lot of them. Christmas, of course. Easter, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Halloween, Thanksgiving, and, of course, birthdays. They are the same every year because, she says, that's how you create family traditions. By hanging the same flags and ornaments and using the same dishes and tablecloths. Every year, on every event, I evaluate my dopamine. I wait for a surge to come when I see the things from these boxes. The advent calendar, the fake spiders and ghosts, the little white lights that get strung around the tree we get at that fake farm 3 exits past the hand of God on the interstate. I remember when it used to happen, before, when we lived in our shitty apartment. Somewhere along the way, it stopped. Now I only get that rush from things outside the walls of this house. My people at the SSS. Ian. Thoughts of college. I don't have time to feel sad about it, though it's right there, knocking on the door. I have too much to do. I go through box after box until one of them makes me stop. I haven't seen this box since I was 10, a box that used to live in the closet at our shitty apartment that is sealed with the silver duct tape my mom used to keep the roaches from squeezing through the floorboards. It was one of the boxes that my grandparents put out for the collectors the day after we ran for our lives when I was 5. My mom had a friend who lived down the street. And she called my mom to tell her there was all this stuff on the curb, and she could see my mom's old field hockey stick laid right on top. My mom waited until the middle of the night, and then she drove us to that curb and loaded all the boxes and bags of our things into her car. Well, not everything, because the car was small. She had to leave my bassinet where I slept after I was born, and my baby clothes and toys, and she said it was okay because I wasn't a baby anymore. But still, she smoked 2 cigarettes after we drove away and left them behind. I think she knew she was the one who would miss them. The boxes and bags stayed there, shoved into every crevice of that car for 3 weeks when we lived in a shelter with other moms and their kids. And my mom learned how to dress and act grown up so she could get a job in an office. And when she got a job and saved 2 weeks of paychecks, we moved into our shitty apartment and took all the boxes and bags out of the car and unpacked them wherever they would fit. She unpacked everything, even that old field hockey stick, which she kept next to her side of the bed in case someone broke in. The only box she never unpacked was this one. She opened it and then closed it right back up the second she saw what was inside. I never asked her what it held because it didn't concern me. But now, I can't resist. I pull off the duct tape, open the flaps, and find books. I recognize them right away because I have the same ones in my bedroom. Yearbooks. I pull them out, one by one, checking the dates. She has 3 of them, and when I look inside, I find her picture in the 9th grade, then 10th grade, then 11th grade, the year she had me. She never finished that grade, but her picture was still in the yearbook. I was born in November, after the school pictures were taken. My heart gets jumpy now, as I realize that somewhere in these books is also my father. She said he played football. She said he left before junior year, that his family moved away before I was born so he wouldn't have to deal with being a teen dad and wouldn't have to pay child support. I realized they also wouldn't have to feel guilty watching my mom being called a whore by her own mother and being forced to leave school. They left so their son could live his dreams after he'd stolen my mom's. I go back through and match all the 9th grade names to all the 11th grade names, and not one boy is missing. I start from the first page of the first yearbook and look for the things people wrote, like, love you, have a great summer, stay sexy. Yuck. In the 10th grade yearbook, I do the same, and there are even more comments. And then one that catches my eye. It's on the faculty page. A teacher named Mr. Nelson. He's young and cute, and there's a heart drawn around his face in a red marker. I know before I open the next yearbook, the one for junior year, what I will find. Or more importantly, what I won't find. Mr. Nelson. I go back to the 10th grade yearbook and read every single note. And there it is. It's so small I can barely see it. It's from the friend who lived up the street from us, who told us about our things being left on the curb for the garbage collector. Her name is Peg, and she wrote, loved being in bio with you, Mrs. N. And then a smiley face shaped like a heart. Mrs. N. An inside joke about Mr. Nelson and my mom. Mr. Nelson. Mr. Piece of Shit Nelson. My father. Lies, lies, lies. How did I miss this? How did I not predict it from everything I know, everything I've learned? I close the yearbooks and put them away. I shut the box, leaving the silver duct tape to hang from the sides. It droops like a beaten-down warrior, old from 11 years in storage and weary from keeping this secret locked away. And I think that my mom still looks young and beautiful, and so I make a new rule. Rule 36. A justified lie is easily told. Then I continue my search for Dusty's stupid gun. Chapter 20. I can't get this new rule out of my thoughts. It makes me angry, along with so many other things, fueling fire in my head. My mom's lie and what it might mean, my shithead father, Dusty thinking I'm not worthy of financial help for college. But there's no time for being angry. I need a plan and I don't have one. But I will. There's no choice. I skip school. I call my advisor and say that I'm too upset about everything that's happened, and she believes me and says she'll mark me down as sick. I haven't missed a day of school in over a year. I text Keller, and she says she's fine. There are no strange cars on the street. I text Ian on his private phone, ask if he's found anything about Agent Zellman, but he doesn't respond. I call the Triple S, and Janice answers, and for a second, just hearing her voice makes my throat close up and my words leave me, but I don't have time to indulge in this feeling. So I close my eyes and think about my plan and say what I need to about the inventory and the stock of pans and how I will rotate everything when I come in because I'm coming in early. And then, when the rest of my world is in order, I ride my bike to the library. The building is old and looks like something from Harry Potter. A weathered brownstone with creeping ivy, mildewed plaster, thick gray glass, and tarnished brass doorknobs. There are old ladies at the front desk, and old ladies at the information desk, and old ladies stacking books. It's worn from overuse and disrepair because no one in Sawyer pays for books. I go to the old lady at the front desk and hand her $3, asking for quarters. Then I go to the lobby, where there's a payphone, and lay the quarters out on the dirty metal shelf just below it. Finally, I take Clay Cooper's cell phone from my jacket pocket and turn it on for the first time since Friday night. It comes to life. I move through the screens. It has very few messages, none. Memos, one. No words, just a series of numbers. I open the contacts last. There are 7. Then I open the voice memo app on my phone. I start to make the calls, putting in quarters, pushing the worn metal keys. The first number has been disconnected. The quarters release. I record a note. The second number has been disconnected. The quarters release. I record a note. On the third, the phone rings, and I feel my body freeze as the ringing stops, but no one says hello. My plan was to stay silent and let them speak, because that's what people do. My plan was to let them say what people say when no one replies, like, "Are you there? What's going on?" Maybe they would say more. Maybe I would recognize the voice. Rule number 16. People do not like silence. If you are silent, people will fill that space with words and might share information that you can use to your advantage. But now this rule is being used against me. Several seconds pass, and I feel the discomfort building. I'm supposed to initiate the conversation, but I hold fast. Do not speak. Do not speak. The tables begin to turn. I hear breathing, a sigh of frustration. But then the phone clicks and the quarters drop. This time not into the return slot, but into the well where they make a clanking sound. Metal on metal, because no one ever empties it. I will myself to keep calling, dropping quarters, dialing. There are no more active numbers. Only that one. Only the one with the breathing and the sigh. I begin to sweep the quarters from the shelf into my hand when the phone rings, and I leap away from it. I stop, stare at the receiver that hangs on the side. My hand moves, about to go to it, but then I think, don't be stupid. I slide the quarters into my back pocket and use the sleeve of my coat to wipe down everything I've touched. I think about the quarters in the well and wish now that I had not touched them with my bare hands, because now my fingerprints are inside this box on those quarters. And who uses a payphone when they don't need to? The woman at the desk will remember I asked for change, because who does that either? So many mistakes already, when I thought I was being so careful and clever. I have no business doing what I'm doing. I turn toward the doors and think that I'll head straight to work and forget that I ever made these calls that let someone know I have the phone. Because that's what I have done. I have let them know. I hear a ping. A text message. I start to reach in my right jacket pocket for my cell phone, but I stop and wait. It pings again. It's not my phone. It's Coop's phone. Coop's phone is pinging. I take it out of my left jacket pocket and flip it open. The number I called from the library has first called me back on the payphone and now sent me a text. I can't open it. I can't bear to find out. Do they know it's me? It could be anyone. It could be the police. It could be Regina Cooper. I started this. I chose this path. I take a deep breath, because I don't want to look. I don't want to know what I've done. I want to go back to being a girl who works at the SSS, keeping her head down so she can get out of this place once and for all. I feel the air rush from my body. My head is light. I have to do this. I flip open the phone and read the words. I read them again. I read them a third time before I understand what's happening. I run outside and get on my bike. I ride as fast as I can, letting the energy out of my body until my mind can make sense of things. The text can only mean one thing. It reads, "Well, hello, Charlie. Someone knows I have the phone." I think through the possibilities and decide that this is most likely Barry sending me a message. And if I'm right, he knows I have what he wants, and he wants me to know he knows, so I'll be scared. Not just for myself, but for my people, the people I love. As my legs move, pushing the pedals, taking me away from the library and the breathing at the other end of the phone and the words on the text, my mind finds space to think. Barry wants the phone, but really, he wants what's on the phone, the number from the memo app. It must lead to his money. There's nothing else here, no other reason to want this phone. The money he gave Coop to clean, that he's now owed, but that Coop can't deliver, because Coop is dead. So he needs this phone, and I have it in my jacket pocket. I stop pedaling on Highway 65 right in front of a small strip mall with a liquor store and a laundromat. I take out the phone, open the memo app, and memorize the number from the one entry. I want to write it down, but that's not the smart thing to do. If it's only in my head, I'll have more power. This is the one time I need my memory to be extraordinary. I slow my breathing and close my eyes and see the numbers in my mind. 345-6292-879-21704. I repeat them over and over, and then also notice how they relate to one another, the sequence. These are all good tricks for remembering things, and they'd better work. Please, God, let them work. I'm pretty sure this number matches the number I found on a piece of paper in Coop's safe at the Triple S. It's not a phone number. I don't know what it is, but I will. I delete everything on the phone except the text message from the library. I open it and send a reply. You'll never find it. It's not the most clever thing in the world, but it will do. Now I have to get rid of this thing. Chapter 21.
Hey, Charlie. How have you been?
What are you doing here?
Oh, your mother told me you were working today. I thought we could just catch up for a minute. Outside, where no one can hear us. So, how have you been? How are you holding up?
Fine. But I really need to go in. My shift is about to start.
I won't keep you long. And I'm glad to see you're doing okay. You've been through a lot these past couple of days.
What do you mean?
Well, the police interview, your boss being murdered. It must be very upsetting for everyone.
I guess.
Have people been talking about it?